Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, wishing you all a very happy and peaceful Easter. In a few moments, you can hear our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel, a special one this week, as well as our Vatican Week in Review with Joan Lewis. But first of all, we join Chris Altieri, who brings us Pope Benedict XVI's words during the Easter Urbi and Orbi address. Dramatic words.
Pope Benedict XVI launched an urgent appeal for an end to conflict and the establishment of peace in the world on Easter Sunday during the traditional Urbi et Orbi blessing after Mass in St. Peter's Square. The Middle East was a special focus of the Holy Father's Urbi et Orbi address, with the Holy Father praying that the risen Christ might grant hope to the region and enable all the ethnic, cultural, and religious groups there to work together to advance the common good and respect for human rights. Particularly in Syria, said Pope Benedict, may there be an end to bloodshed and an immediate commitment to the path of respect, dialogue, and reconciliation as called for by the international community.
In Syria in particular, cesse lo spargimento di sangue.
The Pope went on to pray that the many refugees from Syria who are in need of humanitarian assistance might find the acceptance and solidarity capable of relieving their dreadful suffering. Pope Benedict also prayed that the Paschal victory might encourage the Iraqi people to spare no effort in pursuing the path of stability and development. In the Holy Land, he said, may Israelis and Palestinians courageously take up anew the peace process. The press office of the Holy See on Sunday also confirmed that Pope Benedict will travel to Lebanon in September to present his post-synodal exhortation on the Middle East. The Pope also prayed for the peoples of the continent of Africa, asking God especially to sustain the continent's Christian communities, grant them hope in facing their difficulties, and make them peacemakers and agents of development in the societies to which they belong.
Il Signore vittorioso sul male e sulla morte sostenga le comunità cristiane del continente africano.
Pope Benedict prayed particularly for the suffering populations of the Horn of Africa, as well as for the Great Lakes region, for Sudan and South Sudan, asking God to grant their inhabitants the power of forgiveness. The Pope's thoughts also turned to Mali, which is at present experiencing what he described as delicate political developments in the wake of a military coup and a separatist rebellion. The Pope prayed for Nigeria, which in recent times has experienced savage terrorist attacks, asking that the joy of Easter might provide the country and its people the strength needed to take up anew the building of a society that is peaceful and respectful of the religious freedom of all its citizens.
Buona Pasqua a tutti. May the Christian Church of Risen Christ be with you all.
And now, stepping back in time, Chris brings us the Pope's words during the homily of the Easter Vigil Mass.
Light makes life possible. It makes encounter possible. It makes communication possible. It makes knowledge, access to reality and to truth, possible.
La luce rende possibile la vita, rende possibile l'incontro, rende possibile la comunicazione.
Because this is true, the darkness enshrouding God and obscuring values is the real threat to our existence and to the world in general. These were just some of the words Pope Benedict XVI addressed to the faithful in his homily during the Easter Vigil Mass in St. Peter's Basilica on the night separating Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday, for which the light of Christ, risen from the dead, is a central theme.
Lumen Christi.
Beginning in silence and darkness, the Paschal fire is lit, and with it the Easter candle, the light of which begins as a far-off flicker before spreading until it splits the night with the brilliance of a thousand torches.
Columne illuminatione purgavi.
To say that God created light means that God created the world as a space for knowledge and truth, as a space for encounter and freedom, as a space for good and for love. Matter, said Pope Benedict, is fundamentally good. Being itself is good. And evil does not come from God-made being. Rather, it comes into existence only through denial. It is a no.
Nel battesimo il Signore dice a colui che lo riceve, fiat lux sia la luce.
With the resurrection of Jesus, said Pope Benedict, light itself is created anew. He draws all of us after him into the new light of the resurrection, and he conquers all darkness. This is possible because, with the sacrament of baptism, which the early Christians called also photismos, illumination or enlightenment, and which the Holy Father ministered to 8 catechumens from 4 continents, the Lord has built a bridge across to us through which the new day reaches us. I'm Chris Altieri.
And our thanks there go to Chris Altieri for bringing us these reports. Moving on in the broadcast, time to join Jill Bevilacqua as she presents There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins with the Gospel reading.
Early in the morning, on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. She saw that the stone had been moved away. So she ran off to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and told them, "The Lord has been taken from the tomb. We don't know where they have put him." At that, Peter and the other disciples started out on their way toward the tomb. They were running side by side, but then the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He did not enter, but bent down to peer in and saw the wrappings lying on the ground. Presently, Simon Peter came along behind him and entered the tomb. He observed the wrappings on the ground and saw the piece of cloth, which had covered the head, not lying with the wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Then the disciple who had arrived first at the tomb went in. He saw and believed. Remember, as yet, they did not understand the scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead.
When Jesus was buried on the evening of Good Friday, there was not only among his friends an atmosphere of sadness and despondency, but also a sense of urgency. For it was the vigil of the Sabbath, known as the Day of Preparation. And as a biblical scholar writes,
that particular Sabbath was especially festive because it coincided with the Passover. The obligation to rest was one of the most binding and began with the appearance of the first stars of the vigil.
This is confirmed by what Luke writes.
It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was imminent. Meanwhile, the women who had come from Galilee with Jesus were following behind. They took note of the tomb and of the position of the body. Then they returned and prepared spices and ointments, and on the Sabbath day they rested, as the law required.
Whether they slept, though, is another matter. It must surely have been the longest Sabbath they ever remembered. And unknown to them, it was also the last Sabbath of all, to be lived in the old way, or at any rate with any real conviction. And at some point, as we may read,
the first day of the week, in memory of Jesus' resurrection, was named by Christians the Lord's Day, and the obligation of keeping it as a holy day was transferred to it from the Sabbath,
wrote St. Jerome in the 4th century.
The Lord's Day, the day of the resurrection, the day of Christians, that is our day.
And St. Isidore in the 7th century wrote,
this day the Jews did not observe, but it was declared by the Christians in honour of the Lord's resurrection, and the celebration began from that time.
But for the holy women on that first Easter morning, this was all in the future. And the old Sabbath was barely over when, at the first sight of dawn, as Luke writes, they went to the tomb with the spices they had prepared. The embalming, however, was never to take place. Meanwhile, what had been going on during that historic Sabbath? Let's listen to this extract from an old homily for Holy Saturday, which is quoted in the 1992 Catechism.
Today, there is a great silence on the earth, a great silence and solitude, a great silence because the King is sleeping. The earth is dismayed and is silent because God made flesh has fallen asleep and has woken those who had been sleeping for centuries. He is going to look for the first father, like the lost sheep. He wants to go down to visit those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. God and his Son go to free from their sufferings Adam and Eve, who are in prison. I am your God, who have become your Son for you. Awake, you who sleep. In fact, I did not create you to remain a prisoner in hell. Arise from the dead. I am the life of the dead.
He descended into hell. The third day he rose again from the dead. In the section devoted to an explanation of the Apostles' Creed, the Catechism comments.
The descent of Christ into the underworld and his resurrection from the dead on the third day are professed in the same article of faith, because in his Easter he made life spring forth from the abyss of death.
Today we very rarely reflect on the descent into hell, perhaps because the word suffers from ambiguity, but also because of our modern distaste for all references to hell and devils. But, as one scholar writes, medieval men and women took the devil and his works more seriously. In their pageants and miracle plays, Christ's descent into hell was vividly represented. The harrowing of hell, as it was called, was based on a popular legend which had its origin in the apocryphal Gospel of Nicodemus. Writes our scholar,
this legend is dramatized in all the English cycles, represented in sculpture and painted glass, and used again and again in the sermons.
A brilliant example of the harrowing of hell in stained glass can still be seen in the 15th century church of St. Mary the Virgin in Fairford, Gloucestershire. I was taken by a friend one summer day to this unique church, which has no fewer than 28 windows in stained glass portraying 1,000 figures. As the guidebook declares proudly, no other parish church in England has retained a complete set of late medieval glass. Window 6, divided into three parts, shows the deposition on the left, the entombment in the centre, and on the right, the harrowing. Here, as the guidebook explains,
Christ rescues Adam and Eve from hell and proclaims the good news to imprisoned souls. One soul, still impenitent, is seen behind red-hot bars.
And you can almost feel the heat. Although we use the word harrowing today as an adjective, meaning painful in the extreme, referring to an experience or even only something painful to watch, a dictionary will tell us that the verb to harrow was a 13th century word meaning to rob or despoil, and that it was used especially with reference to Christ's descent to hell to carry off the souls of righteous people. Back in the 9th century, these lines formed part of an Easter hymn by Rabanus Maurus, abbot of the famous monastery of Fulda in Germany.
Breathing out his soul, Christ entered the underworld, triumphant. He banished the shadows of death. The just he snatched away. The enemy he bound, giving heaven to the good, while evil men were left in their pains.
But by Easter morning, all this has been accomplished, and the scene shifts once again to earth, to the empty tomb. What happened next, and who came to the tomb at first light, is recounted in their different ways and with varying details by all four evangelists. But who saw the risen Jesus first? This was often asked us as children by our teacher of religion. It was, of course, a catch question. Although it's not mentioned in any of the Gospels, clearly the first person Jesus appeared to must have been his mother. To the evangelists, it would have seemed too obvious to need recording. Not so obvious would have been his appearance to other women. As for who went to the tomb with the spices, among a variety of names recorded, only one appears in all four Gospels, that of Mary Magdalene. And today's Gospel, that of John, chosen to be read on Easter Sunday in all 3 years of the liturgical cycle, gives prominence to that one name, Mary Magdalene. Reading on, we find that after they'd been to the tomb, Peter and John returned home. Mary Magdalene, however, who must have followed them back to the tomb, stayed behind, weeping. And it was then that she stooped to look into the tomb. There she saw two angels, who asked her why she was weeping. They have taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they have put him. Something prompts her to turn round, and standing there is the risen Jesus. Taking him for the gardener, she asks if he has removed the body. But he speaks only one word, Mary, and as St. John writes,
she knew him then. Rabuni, she said in Hebrew, master.
What followed is told this way by poet George MacDonald.
He stands in haste, he cannot stop. Home to his God he fares. Go, tell my brothers I go up to my Father, mine and theirs. Run, Mary, lift thy heavenly voice, cry, cry and heed not how. Make all the new risen world rejoice, its first apostle, thou.
Apostle, from the Greek apostolos, is a messenger. Mary Magdalene is described in the liturgical calendar simply as disciple of the Lord. But because of the unique privilege of being the first to see the risen Lord, she's been called the apostle of the apostles. and in the revised calendar, her feast day on the 22nd of July has been classified as an obligatory memorial for the whole church. Not only John records that Magdalene saw the risen Jesus first, Mark, in his final summing up, writes,
"He, rising early the first day of the week, appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils."
Which, as Piero Bargellini points out, does not necessarily mean that she was a sinner. For the traditional image of Mary Magdalene is that of the penitent prostitute, usually identified as the woman who poured precious ointment over the feet of Jesus, causing Judas to exclaim, "Why wasn't this ointment sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor?" Modern scholarship shows us a different Magdalene. Freed of her demons, she follows Jesus from Galilee, together with other women, tends to his needs, stands at the foot of the cross, and is rewarded at the tomb by the vision of the risen Lord. And now let's listen to this Easter poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who in the opening verse invites us symbolically to imitate the woman in the Gospel and spare no expense in celebrating the risen Christ.
"Break the box and shed the nard. Stop not now to count the cost. Hither bring pearl, opal, sard. Reck not what the poor have lost. Upon Christ throw all away. Know ye, this is Easter Day. Build his church and deck his shrine, empty though it be on earth. Ye have kept your choicest wine, let it flow for heavenly mirth. Pluck the harp and breathe the horn, know ye not 'tis Easter morn? Gather gladness from the skies, take a lesson from the ground. Flowers do ope their heavenward eyes, and a springtime joy have found. Earth throws winter's robes away, decks herself for Easter Day. Beauty now for ashes wear, perfumes for the garb of woe, chaplets for dishevelled hair, dances for sad footsteps slow. Open wide your hearts that they let in joy this Easter Day. Seek God's house, in happy throng, crowded let his table be. Mingle praises, prayer and song, singing to the Trinity. Henceforth let your souls alway make each morn an Easter Day."
And while our thanks there go to Gilby Villacqua for bringing us this beautiful programme, it's time to step back in time a little and take a look at the Vatican Week. That's with, you may have guessed, Joan Lewis. So, Joan, we're recording early because of Easter.
All the Holy Week and holiday and holy day activities, the Triduum and two papal masses on the Triduum, the big events of Good Friday, obviously, culminating with the Via Crucis, the way of the cross at the Colosseum.
That's always very impressive, isn't it?
Very, very much so. And then, of course, Saturday night, and then another time, the Pope has two masses within a framework of just a few hours, practically. On Saturday night, the vigil in St. Peter's Basilica, and then Sunday morning, the Easter Sunday of the Resurrection Mass with the Pope and his Urbi and Orbi blessing. So we're at this point, we can't say to people, stay tuned, they will have heard what the Holy Father said, whereas we're speaking a little bit in advance. But Holy Week is upon us with Palm Sunday and all.
Palm Sunday, then.
But, you know, actually, if I can take just a second, I'd love to mention something that happened. The news came out the day before Palm Sunday, and that is that the Holy Father has donated $100,000 to aid the people of Syria. Now, the Pontifical Council Cor Unum, of course, meaning one heart, that is often called the charity arm of the Holy Father, and they had announced last weekend that the Pope made a donation of $100,000 in support of the people of Syria. And we know the Pope has mentioned the violence and the problems there many, many times and is always praying for those who suffer. And it was Monsignor Gianpietro D'Altozzo, who is the secretary of Cor Unum, who arrived in Syria last weekend to deliver the Holy Father's gift to representatives of the Syrian church. So if you look at Holy Week, you look at the passion and suffering of our Lord, you look at a different but perhaps in some ways similar passion and suffering of so many people in the world who do suffer
and Syria
violence. Yes, exactly. But, Palm Sunday was the beautiful event that it always is. It's in St. Peter's Square, the massive participation of cardinals and bishops in all their finery and red vestments and and the procession in the square, where obviously the Pope blesses all the palms. And as a matter of fact, he and the cardinals are holding palm fronds that I think must have been 5 or 6 feet tall, very, very big fronds.
Whereas here they bless olive branches, no?
And the Pope carried the palm, but there you'd see in the square, this always impressed me when I came to Italy, you would see olive and palm. In the U.S., any parish I've ever, been a part of has always had the palm branches. And then we bring them in on Ash Wednesday the next year to be burned for the ashes to be used on the subsequent Ash Wednesday. Because there is a very specific way to be rid of blessed palms. And you are supposed to burn them, obviously in a supervised setting, or you can you can bury them in a garden. But you're never, ever to throw palms away. So from one year to the next, when you get new ones and you say, what'll I do with the old ones? Well, that's what you do. Well, Palm Sunday was very beautiful, and I loved the Pope's description of Palm Sunday. It's like some year after year, listening to John Paul and then Benedict, it's like, how can they always come up with something new for something that's very old, a 2-millennia-old celebration like Palm Sunday? And he said, Palm Sunday is the great doorway leading into Holy Week, the week where the Lord makes his way towards the culmination of his earthly existence. He goes to Jerusalem. He goes up to Jerusalem to fulfill the scriptures and be nailed to the wood of the cross. And the Pope calls this the throne from which he will reign forever, drawing to himself humanity of every age and offering to all the gift of redemption. And if I can insert a little tidbit in here. I remember on my first trip to the Holy Land, our guide explained one day, he said, you know how often in the Bible you will read about Jesus or the apostles or something going up to Jerusalem? Or you might read they were going down to Jericho. And in fact, I always wondered, what do you mean going up to Jerusalem? Why don't they just say he was going to Jerusalem? Well, Jerusalem was on this hill. And if you were coming from certain other parts of Israel, of the Holy Land, you had to go up to get to Jerusalem. So very literally, they mean that in the Bible. And if you went from Jerusalem to Jericho, you had to go down because it was down a hill. So just a little bit of trivia, which I learned when I was in the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Joan, Palm Sunday also marks World Youth Day in
right.
a sense, no?
Exactly. And this year, celebrating the 26th World Youth Day. And interestingly enough, then on Monday, April 2nd, the Holy Father did meet with 5,000 young people from Madrid who had were accompanied by their Archbishop, of course, the Cardinal Archbishop of Madrid. They
Madrid
were thanking.
Is the place where the last World Youth Day was held.
Last August, exactly. And they came to thank the Holy Father for having come. And then this was on Monday, and then there was a press conference this week also to present World Youth Day 2013, which is going to be held in Rio de Janeiro. And
Brazil.
In Brazil. And the Archbishop, of course, Archbishop Tempesta was there from Rio, and they presented the preliminaries of the program and talked about the website in about 5 or 6 different languages. So the registration won't begin until this summer, but in any event, all the information's out there in multi-languages. And it's the second time in the history of World Youth Day, the very first international World Youth Day was held in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And so this is only the second time in all these years that an international Youth Day has returned to Latin America. And then I'm sure our listeners know that every Palm Sunday, not alternate years, but every Palm Sunday is automatically World Youth Day. And then every 2, and in some instances 3 years, we have the International Youth Day. So looking back at the events of the week, we have the Pope is recovering from his very long airplane flights to and from Mexico and Cuba, his 6-day visit to those countries. So it was kind of quiet at the end of last week. So then we had Palm Sunday. And, of course, we had the audience on Wednesday in which, as he always does when returning from a trip, the Pope talks about that trip. And it was really amazing. He was very enthusiastic about his trip to Mexico and Cuba. He talked about what he had in mind before he went, the joy of the people, the enthusiasm in both countries of the people. And he said, I realized what I intended to do when I visited those countries. And he said he wanted to confirm the people in faith and in hope. And he talked a little bit more at length about his, or this was my impression, about his time in Cuba and Santiago, the two masses he celebrated in Cuba. And he asked people to be aware, especially now at the time of the Passion, of God's reconciling and transforming love. And he said, let us allow that love to transform our lives and enable us to celebrate with joy the mystery of the resurrection. So that was Wednesday. And then, of course, you know, we have all the Holy Week events. The Holy Father has mm-hmm. celebrated the Chrism Mass in St. Peter's Square Thursday morning. And but I do want to mention two interesting things about the going back to the audience for a second. At the end of the audience, the Pope told the 11,000 pilgrims in St. Peter's Square, reminded them that Wednesday, April 4th every year, marks the United Nations International Day for Landmine Awareness. And the Holy Father said, now there is, of course, a convention banning mines, but that doesn't stop a lot of people who still want to kill others with this insidious way. And the Pope encouraged all the people in the world who are working hard to free mankind from these terrible and underhanded devices. But one thing that happened, which was not seen by the public, and this is so cute, not seen by the public, but happened before the Pope got into the white jeep to go to St. Peter's Square for the audience. An Italian chocolate company gave the Holy Father a 6-foot-tall Easter egg, chocolate Easter egg. I've forgotten how many kilos and kilos and kilos of chocolate.
He looked a bit perplexed at this Easter egg, didn't he? Because it was huge.
It was absolutely huge. Well, taller than he is. And then the Easter egg is all, there's like a saran wrap over it, but it had the Pope's papal coat of arms on that. And he's apparently giving it to a home for juvenile offenders or delinquents or something like that. But our listeners should know that in Italy, the tradition of giving Easter eggs, they can be 2 inches in size or 2 or 3 feet tall. And obviously, the bigger they are, the more costly they are, the more chocolate there is, the more beautifully they're wrapped. But inside, there's always some little gift. So we probably will never know until this is opened in the home for juveniles if this chocolate company put a gift in for the Holy Father. So if we find that out, we will bring that to you right here on this show. But and you also, people in Italy, because this actually happened to me once, can special order chocolate eggs and put gifts inside, you know, jewelry or maybe a special little toy for a child or 2 airline tickets for a summer vacation. So anyway, well, let's wish our listeners a very blessed and meaningful and happy Easter.
Thank you very much, Jen. You were listening there to EWTN Bureau Chief here in Rome, Joan Lewis. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.